now more than ever, people need to go within and plug into that cellular memory, plug into divine source, detach as much as possible from the matrix. A lot of these people that have all these abilities, who have celestial star ancestry, they're operating not only throughout this cosmos, but in higher planes, and they're working against the Draco Empire. The photonic energy and the cosmic rays will activate our higher centers. And it's incumbent upon us to ride that frequency wave. Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you are listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. Today, my very special guest is Gary David. Gary is an author and independent researcher who has studied Southwestern archaeological ruins and rock art for over 25 years. His books about the Hopi and other ancestral pebble cultures of Arizona and Mexico include The Orion Zone, subtitled Ancient Star Cities of the American Southwest, Eyes of the Phoenix, Mysterious Visions and Secrets of the American Southwest, The Kivas of Heaven, subtitle Ancient Hopi Star Lore, and Star Shrines and Earthworks of the Desert Southwest. Gary David, how are you?
I'm fine, James. Good to be here.
I'm glad to have you on the show. Your subject matter and the research you do is of such compelling interest to me, and I'm sure to many of our listeners on the Cosmic Switchboard Show. For the benefit of my listeners, could you tell them a bit about yourself and how you got involved in this work?
I've lived here in Arizona over 20 years, about 25 years, really. And I've been working with the Hopi people and some of the other Pueblo tribes in the region. This is in Arizona and northern Arizona mostly. I've been going to Kachina dances and interacting with the people up there. And, you know, it's a fascinating culture that's still doing the ceremonies up there on three primary mesas that the Hopi live on. And they're still doing their ancient ceremonies from over 1,000 years ago, and it's still being carried on, and the tradition is still being carried on of these ancient people. You know, they're people, basically they were farmers, and they still are. They grow corn, beans, and squash for the most part, and they still do this dry farming, use this dry farming method, which relies on natural irrigation instead of, industrial irrigation. You know, they use the powers of the universe and their prayer in order to bring the rain to the high desert of Arizona. And it's just a fascinating group of people that are dedicated to keeping the whole world in balance. That's their basic goal of the culture itself, is to do their ceremonies, and it's a whole cycle of ceremonies throughout the year that they perform. And they're doing this basically to keep the whole world in balance. The Hopi are called the people of peace, and they want to see peace in the world and balance. In fact, a lot of the Hopi in the mid-20th century, Hopi elders went to the UN to try to talk about, you know, getting the world back into balance and praying for peace. So, you know, these people are very dedicated. It's a hard life up there. You know, some of the villages, and there are about 12 or 13 villages up on these three, spread across these three primary mesas. And they lived in what are called pueblos. They're kind of like stone apartment buildings. And they live in a very kind of a primitive way. At least some of the villages still carry on this tradition, and they don't have any running water or electricity to the villages. you can go up and visit these villages and talk to the people and participate, at least witness some of the ceremonies that go on up there. So it's a really fascinating group of people that have carried on this tradition, this mythological lore from the ancient past, and they're still talking about some of their various mythologies, and we can get into some of the legends that the Hopi people have about coming to this continent and various other things.
Yes, in your research, you discuss that they describe their coming to the third world in particular, or the fourth world. Correct me if I'm wrong, and they describe ascending or descending to this world as a result of climbing or descending a large reed. And then in your research, you determine that in the Hopi language, the big reed corresponds to the Milky Way. So it seems as if their cosmology and their lore suggest that they believe they come from beyond our planet. And in this case, the Orion constellation. Could you elaborate on that, Gary?
Yeah, the Hopi have a legend about coming up from the third world, which is a previous era to this one. The Hopi, I should explain the different world eras because time periods, because it's much like the Maya in Central America in southern Mexico. They have these cycles of time that have been – the people have lived in, and then the whole world was destroyed. And the Hopi are now living in the fourth world. They say we are all in this fourth world together, but they've survived three different worlds previous to this one. And the way they got up to this one, they've climbed up from the bottom of Grand Canyon through a great reed. That's the way they conceptualize it, is coming up through a giant reed at the bottom of Grand Canyon. And they climbed out of Grand Canyon, and they climbed up out of the canyon and began to populate the Colorado Plateau, which in the Four Corners region of the United States. But, you know, as you said, they conceptualize this reed as the Milky Way, too, because the word Sangwuka, the Hopi word Sangwuka means big reed, and that's the word that refers to the Milky Way itself. So a lot of the Hopi elders believe that their star ancestors led them up through this big reed to this planet.
Does this correspond in any way to the story of the Hopi Sipapuni or the Hopi Sipapu?
Yeah, the Sipapu is an actual physical structure. It's a natural geological structure, and it's located – you could find it on Google Earth, in fact. It's located on the north bank of the Little Colorado River, and it's what is called a travertine dome. It's a limestone dome built up of mineral waters through many years, and it's like it's about 100 feet across, you know, and there's got a hole right in the center of it that the water comes out of, and I hope they believe that they came up through this particular space. This dome in at the bottom of Grand Canyon. That's the way they expressed it in their mythology, at any rate. Mythology is open to a lot of different interpretations, and you don't have to take these things in a literal sense. And of course, I should stress to listeners that the word myth has been abused by a lot of people, and they think, well, it's an untruth. But a lot of ancient cultures used a mythology to explain their experience in the world, their historical experience in the world. So it's not something that should be discounted just because of the term myth or mythology. But, yeah, they came up out of this Sipapuni, came up out of the Grand Canyon, and they met with the first thing that they met with is a god named Masau. Masau is a god of this earth plane, but he's also the god of the underworld. He's a god of fire. He's a very kind of a spooky looking god. He has a large bulbous head, big round eyes, and a big round mouth. And the way we know this is the Hopi make Kachina dolls, the dolls that represent certain spirits or gods. And we can see what this god looks like, and the god still hangs around today, in fact. We can still see what this god looks like by the Kachina dolls that are made by the Hopi. They're carved by the Hopi. But this god had, very long arms, spindly arms, and it was a tall creature with long feet and long hands. But and like I said, large round eyes and a large round mouth. And the skin of this god was gray. In fact, the Hopi word M-A-S or Mas, the root word of Masau, literally means gray. And if you look at the pictures, I have pictures in my books about this, describing this god, Masau, and he looks just like an extraterrestrial gray that we can see about. I mean, it's very, very close to the grays that we're familiar with from recent literature and recent images on television and the like.
What's interesting is that the depictions of Kachinas, and correct me if I'm wrong, Kachinas means roughly translated messenger or messengers. Some of these Kachina depictions and dolls, they seem to show beings with, and it varies from like a conical-shaped head or like a cylindrical-shaped head, a box-shaped head. And one could infer perhaps that it could be a representation of a helmet or of a bulbous-headed being of some kind. And I think it is suggestive that this Masao being is described as being gray and having like big round eyes.
Yeah, exactly. The Kachinas, he technically is a god, but the Kachinas are spirit messengers, as you say. They're kind of intercessors between the world of the gods and the world of the people, between the plane of the sky beings and the plane of the earth people. These Kachinas come to the Hopi mesas. As I said, the Hopi live on three primary mesas in northern Arizona. And these Kachinas, they are spirits, but dances are held in the villages starting in about April or even somewhat earlier, starting after the winter solstice. And they run through after the summer solstice. And the dances are held in the village plaza. And the men, and usually men, it's the men that do the dancing, they put on these masks in order to become this actual Kachina. In fact, their own ego or their own personhood is kind of abandoned when they put on this mask and they become this actual Kachina spirit. And as you say, there are many different types of Kachinas. The Kachinas can represent any kind of earth spirit or earth force, sky spirit. And there are many. It's hard to describe them because it's so multifaceted. The Kachina mask can be circular or dome-shaped or cylindrical, or they can have horns and they can have feathers. And some are like bug-eyed, or some have just slits for eyes. And as you say, there are some that look like helmets, like helmets that would be worn by alien creatures. So these Kachinas are definitely from an alternate dimension, and they come to the people, the Hopi people, and they are always benevolent. They're benevolent creatures. that bring rainfall and bring good spirits to people. And the people are glad when the kachinas come. The kachina season, as I say, lasts from, you know, in the springtime when the corn begins to grow. And through about July. July is the last kachina dance that is held. And that's the July is when the monsoon rains come to northern Arizona. The last kachina dance is called the home dance. And that means that the kachinas are going back home to wherever they originate. It might be up in the sky. The Hopi sometimes conceptualize the kachinas living in the San Francisco Peaks, which is about 75 miles southwest of the Hopi Mesas. So, you know, it's a cyclical thing. The kachinas come during the agricultural season. They help the burgeoning corn grow and the beans and the squash, and they help things along agriculturally. And then they go after, you know, after the agriculture has a good hold on the mesas, and you know, then they harvest, of course, in the fall, and there are different harvest dances as well. But these are non-kachina dances without the masks. So it's a whole ritual, ceremonial cycle that is carried on by the Hopi people that is just fascinating.
Now, were the Hopi descended from the Anasazi? What is the relationship between the two?
Okay, the Anasazi, the term, basically it's a term that archaeologists began using in like the 1970s. The word Anasazi is actually a Navajo word. The Navajo, of course, live in the American Southwest as well. In fact, the Navajo reservation surrounds the Hopi reservation. And sometimes the Navajo are thought of as the protectors of the Hopi. And yet at other times they were seen throughout history as kind of antagonistic to the Hopi. So the Navajo came down from the north after 1300 AD. You know, the Navajo are not indigenous to the Southwest. And they came down. The Navajo, they're not agrarian like the Hopi. They're not farmers like the Hopi. They basically were sheep herders. The word Anasazi, it means ancient enemy. So back in the time when the Navajo first migrated into the Southwest, the Navajo and the Hopi had skirmishes and kind of warfare between the two. So the Navajo term Anasazi means ancient enemies, which refers to the Hopi. The Hopi use a term called Hizatsinom. Hizatsinom literally means like ancient people. That's the way they refer to their ancestors instead of using the term Anasazi. Archaeologists today have kind of created a catch-all term, ancient Puebloans, they call them, because there are many different Pueblo groups, that those people that live in those stone apartment buildings. There are different types of Pueblo groups, the Zuni and the Acoma and the Laguna, and there are a whole bunch of different Pueblo people that grew up along the Rio Grande River in New Mexico. So the archaeologists call these people in general as ancestral Puebloans. You know, it's pretty interesting that these people, these ancient people, have this connection to the living Hopi. You know, the Hopi recite the legends of these ancient peoples, especially during the wintertime. They go down into their kivas or their underground prayer chambers and tell these stories, these legends of, you know, coming up through the Sipapuni from the third world into the fourth world, and the various legends that go along with the god Masau. And, you know, it's they carry on this tradition even today.
And for the benefit of our listeners, when the Hopi refer to the four worlds, they're referring to previous civilizations, which ultimately ended in some kind of a cataclysm or a catastrophe. Could you go into that?
The Hopi believe that the different worlds were destroyed. Three different previous worlds were destroyed. The first world, they say, was destroyed by fire, the element of fire. Now, this could be interpreted as perhaps some kind of comet impact or coronal mass ejection from the sun. Some sort of fire hit the earth and destroyed this first world. The first world was like a paradise. It was a world in which the humans and the animals understood each other and could talk to each other. They were, you know, one with nature. It was almost like an Eden. It was a paradise. And but generally, as it always happens, the humans began to be corrupt. And, you know, this happens as we see even today. You know, the humans become corrupt. The society becomes corrupt. And there are social misdeeds and things that go against the ways of the Creator. And this happened to the first world. So the Creator decided to destroy the first world by sending this fire upon the earth. And like I say, it could be a comet that, you know, the comet that hit the earth, 12,000 years ago or 13,000 years ago. It hit North America. There was a huge comet that hit around Canada and so forth, and really destroyed the northern part of North America and into the southern part. So it was a destruction of this particular world that the Hopi sought refuge in underground caves and caverns. And they were led to these caverns by what they call the ant people, or the Anisinom. The ant people are like half human, half insect, and they have thin legs and arms and like bulbous heads, and they have antenna and large eyes. You know, I've seen these ant people depicted in the rock art carved in the cliff walls of northern Arizona. These ant people, you know, help the people survive in these caverns while the destruction of the first world was going on. They helped them survive by, you know, showing them how to sprout beans, for instance, in the caverns. And the Hopi today have this ceremony. It takes place in February. It's called the Powamu ceremony. And they sprout beans in the kiva, which is an underground prayer chamber. It's sort of like the caverns that they sought refuge in. The ant people showed them how to sprout beans and survive in these caves. When it was safe to come out, they came out into the second world. Now, the second world was not quite like a paradise that you would think of the first world. They, you know, the people, they lived and they carried on various trade between groups. It was still fairly peaceful in the second world, but again, this human trait of corruption and societal discord took over and corrupted the people, and the people were doing things against the ways of the Creator, various sorts of sexual deviations and so forth. The Creator decided to destroy the second world, and the second world was destroyed by ice, the element of ice. Some believe that this was actually a pole shift, and the Ice Age took over during this period. And again, the Hopi people survived by going into these caverns, into these underground caves. And the ant people showed them again how to survive in these caves until it was safe to come out, until the ice had receded. And then the Hopi came up into the third world And the third world was an interesting place because the third world began rather primitively, but developed a civilization in which there were cities basically all over the world. And we think of Lemuria, we think of Atlantis, these kinds of places that developed during this time. And there were airships that flew all over the globe. The Hopi have a term for these. They call them flying shields, or Paatuvota is the term that they use. These flying shields that they could fly up into the sky with. And we also think of the Hindu Vimanas, these airships that the ancient Hindu texts, the Ramayana and so forth, talk about. These are right in line with the way the Hopi conceptualize this third world place. And again, the society, the civilization began to be corrupt. And the creator decided to destroy the third world. And the third world was destroyed by a great flood. A great deluge came across the earth. And of course, you know, this is a universal mythology. Cultures all over the world have flood myths. And the Hopi survived this time, not by the ant people, but they simply built rafts, reed rafts, rafts of bamboo, and they floated across the Pacific Ocean from Lemuria to the western coast of North America. And this is how they came to this continent. So there's these three worlds that were destroyed, and now we're living in the fourth world, and many elders believe that we're at the end of the fourth world right now.
We typically think of the Hopi and in general the Native Americans of the Southwest as being essentially landlocked people, but It turns out that they probably came from across the Pacific. And what's also interesting, Gary, is all the correspondences between the Hopi culture and, well, you mentioned earlier Lemuria, the South Pacific. There's even a Hindu connection, which perhaps suggests that there was a global civilization where there may have been a lingua franca. Your book is called The Orion Zone, and your website is called theorionzone.com. What is particularly fascinating to me is the parallels between your research and your findings in the desert Southwest and people such as Adrian Gilbert and Robert Bovall with their findings that, for example, the Giza Pyramid Complex is in alignment with the Orion Constellation Belt. It turns out that is a commonality with the Hopi people. And I believe you mentioned that this creator god of theirs, Masao, may have had something to do with where the location of these Hopi settlements were set up.
Exactly. I'll tell you how I came across this theory that set me on this journey, really. It was 1997, and I had just read Robert Bovall and Adrian Gilbert's book, The Orion Mystery. And, of course, you know, he talks about the belt stars of Orion corresponding to the three major pyramids on the Giza Plateau. And this was all very interesting. To see that a culture would be an ancient culture like that would be so interested in the sky and in the ancient archaeoastronomy as they call it. I was going up to a Kachina dance in northern Arizona. I was driving from the south up to the Hopi mesas, and looking at the mesas in the distance, these three primary mesas, and you know, you can start to daydream a lot when you're driving across the desert. I don't know if you've ever been driving in the Southwest, James, but the vistas just kind of telescope out, and you can basically see forever across the desert landscape. And I was going up to these three mesas, And, you know, the thought occurred to me, well, there are three mesas that the Hopi live on, and they've lived on these mesas at least since 1000 AD, if not earlier. And, you know, maybe there's an Orion correlation right here in Arizona, you know. And I thought, well, that's an interesting thought. So, you know, I kind of put it at the back of my mind. I thought, well, you know, that's something to think about. And I went up to observe one of these Kachina dances in the village plaza. And then when I got home, I took out a map of Arizona and took out a star chart and compared the two of them. And I found that there was a ruined site, an abandoned ruined site, or a village that is currently being inhabited, corresponding to every major star in the constellation Orion. And this was just uncanny. There was a one-to-one correspondence between every star, not just the belt stars, but every star in the constellation Orion. And this kind of set me off on this journey to write my first book, The Orion Zone. And, of course, I went to all these sites, many different sites, Pueblo sites. Some are national monuments right now. Some are state parks. These ancient ruins that are abandoned, that were abandoned, you know, centuries ago by the Hopi. But the Hopi still have an active relationship with these abandoned villages because the spirits are still there in these villages. They still inhabit the place so many centuries ago. You know, this started me on this kind of quest to try to verify this relationship that the Hopi have with the constellation Orion. And it is a real thing that, you know, Orion, they call the belt stars of Orion Hotamkam, which means beads on a string. It refers to the belt stars themselves. The Hopi used the constellation Orion as to synchronize one of their most important ceremonies. As I say, some of the ceremonies are held down in the kivas. There are these prayer chambers that they descend to a ladder in the roof of the chamber. And they go down in there, and there's a hatchway overhead that you can look through and see the sky. And during the winter solstice ceremony, it starts in the middle of the night, not at sunrise, as you might think, but it starts in the middle of the night. And the way they start the ceremony, they see the constellation Orion overhead in this hatchway. And that's the beginning of the particular ceremony that they perform until the dawn. When the sun rises, the farthest south on the horizon. And the Hopi kept track of where the sun rose, of course, throughout the season, so they could build their agricultural calendar. So, you know, the Hopi use this constellation of Orion as a kind of a synchronization of their particular ceremony.
One of the most spectacular sights I've ever seen, Gary, was I was driving up Highway 93, going north on Highway 93 from Arizona up towards Las Vegas. Oh. I was around that area, and just above the horizon at night was Orion, the whole constellation in all its glory. No, take it back. I was actually on Highway 40 passing Needles. That's mm-hmm. it. Mm-hmm. It was flatter. And then right above, because I was headed for Las Vegas, the horizon was Orion. It was a breathtaking spectacle. Another thing that was always of interest to me also is you mentioned in your findings that there seems to be a correlation with the solstices, where a lot of these ancient sites in alignment with the Orion constellation are at. If one goes to certain places at certain times of the year, typically the solstices, there may be like a sunrise or a sunset that they may see. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, the Hopi have what are called sun watchers. The word is Tawa Mungwi, or sun chiefs. And these were actual jobs that these particular men did. They correlated, you know, the way that the sun rose on the horizon to a particular time. They would know when the sun rose over a particular mesa, because they'd start out from a sun watching place, a place that they observed from. And this was the same place every year, because the Hopi, of course, are, you know, lived in one place. They were farmers, so they didn't move around. They weren't nomadic like some of the tribes, but they stayed in the same place all year round. So the sun watchers could observe the eastern horizon, especially, and to see where the sun rose at each particular time of the year. And they needed to know this. They needed to know, for instance, when the summer solstice was and when the winter solstice was, because the sun rose the farthest north and south along the horizon. And they needed to know this for agricultural reasons, when to plant a specific type of corn, for instance, when to gather the eagles for ceremonies during the summer. They gathered the eagles in March, and they would know when this was, when the sun was equidistant between the northern house or the summer's house and the southern house, where the sun lived in these two houses, north and south, furthest north and furthest south along the horizon. You know, it's a very complicated thing that the Hopi had going, and they could pretty accurately tell what time of year it was by where the sun rose, because you can see along the horizon, as you know, James, that you can see little buttes and mesas and so forth, and you can mark them. And if you're in a single place during the year, you can see where the sun is rising over a particular spot on the horizon. I used to do this from my back deck in northern Arizona. I could see Orion rising in the east, and Orion would rise at a certain place, during the year. It came, it first appeared during July, in the early hours of July before the sun rose, and you could tell, where, and the sun was rising. At that time, it started to go south, you know, because it was after the summer solstice. So it's a very complicated system that the Hopi used. They also carved cliffs with particular spirals, okay, that marked where certain little blades of light would come into the spiral at the summer solstice. For instance, at a place in Chaco Canyon, which is in New Mexico, the ancient Hopi, the ancestral Hopi, carved a spiral in the cliff face on what is called Fajada Butte. And during the summer solstice, a little sliver of light bisects this spiral exactly on the summer solstice. Also the winter solstice, there are various ways that they made marks in the rock face to designate the winter solstice, and also both equinoxes, the vernal and autumnal equinoxes. They marked on this diagram on the cliff wall that it's very, very exact. And in the Chaco Canyon, which has many different huge buildings, in one of the largest sites in the American Southwest, some of the buildings themselves were oriented towards the summer solstice, sunrise, and sunset. And also there were lunar alignments with the moon rises, of course, at different parts of the horizon, and there sometimes it rises further north and further south along the horizon. And this is an 18.6-year cycle that this moon goes through, rising at different places on the horizon. And some of these buildings were even aligned to this very complex 18.6 year cycle. These are masters in sky watching. They knew where they were in the season, in the cycle of the year. They could tell exactly where they were. They had a definite calendar created by the stars.
You mentioned earlier the ant people, and you mentioned some of the Kachinas and various Kachinas, and how some of them resembled perhaps even aliens or like bug-like creatures. It's interesting the correspondence with modern-day alien abduction literature. There's the insectoids, there's the mantis beings. Some of the gray beings can be described as looking somewhat bug-like. Another interesting correspondence is there seems to have been another god, if you will, not Masao, but another one that had almost a Quetzalcoatl aspect or nature to him. Would you like to talk about that?
Well, I think you might be referring to the sky. There was a sky god that that the Hopi worshipped, and the name of the sky god was Totucan. And if you look at pictures of Kachina, Kachina dolls, he has a kind of a helmet like I talked about before. I mean, with slit eyes and kind of a helmet, a white helmet that he wears. Okay, and he definitely came from the sky, from the celestial realm. And the Hopi have certain legends about this sky god. For instance, there's a legend that happened that there was a great flood. I mentioned that before. There was a great flood, and this flood was engulfing a particular village. And everybody was running around kind of chaotically, and they were trying to flee this great flood that was going for the village and coming, you know, about to engulf the village. And two twins, a brother and a sister, were kind of left behind in the melee. They were left behind, and everybody fled, and they were kind of left there. But they had to go out and try to find where their parents had gone to. So they went out into the desert, and the first night they camped, and they saw a light on the horizon, and the light got bigger and bigger and bigger, and finally the light came down to earth. Out of this light, this creature came out of the craft that he had descended on. And like I said, he had kind of a helmet on and a sparkly costume. He was wearing clothing that sparkled all over. It's said that the face that in the myth, it says that the face shone like a star, and the costume was glittered like icicles. Now, to a culture that had never seen metal or metallic substances before, you know, icicles would be the closest thing to metallic substances that they could relate to. You know, so the costume, the clothing that this creature wore was glittered like icicles. And this creature said, told the children, "Don't be afraid. I'm a benevolent. I'm a good creature that's here to help you find your parents." And the creature took them up into this craft, and they went high above the earth into this flying shield, like I mentioned before, this Patu Vota. And they hovered over the earth, and the creature fed them, you know, melons and corn and so forth, and then they hovered over the place where the parents had fled to. And then the craft set down on the desert, and the children left this craft and to go find their parents. But the creature, this Sotuknang, said before they left, he said, "Don't worry, I'll come to you again in your dreams to show you the right way to live." Okay, the proper way to live. So the children, you know, went off and were reunited with the parents. So this is a legend about this star being, this star ancestor, or whatever you want to call him, helping these two Hopi children find their parents again. So, and you know, the Hopi have a lot of different legends about these craft coming down. Some craft come down, and the star Kachina comes out and takes a Hopi bride and mates with Hopi women. So, you know, there might be star blood in the Hopi people's genetics. You know, the Hopi have these legends of these people coming down from the sky and, you know, mating with Hopi women. These star Kachinas.
That parallels so many other accounts, i.e. the Nephilim,
exactly,
beholding the women of Earth being fair and came down and mated with them, etc. Mm-hmm. There are so many correspondences. For example, the rock carvings over there, which show what some would regard as like a mantis being. And there's another story which I thought was very interesting, too, in the Hopi lore. In terms of a translation, a linguistic translation, one of these star beings has a kind of a Sumerian connection where the translation is almost Anu as a first name and Naki as another. Could you elaborate on that, Gary?
Yeah, the Hopi word, we talked about these ant people before. I talked about them and how they helped the people survive. And they were, you know, basically benevolent people that helped the Hopi survive these two different world cataclysms. The destruction of the first world and then the destruction of the second world. And the Hopi word for ant is Anu, and the Hopi word for friend is Naki. So you put those two together, the Anunnaki, you know, the sons of the god who mated with the daughters of men, you know, to produce these giants in the earth. And the Hopi also have these Kachinas who actually are giants, you know, and I've seen some of these Kachina dances where they portray these giant like creatures, and I was at this one Kachina dance, and this one Kachina came out, and the mask was just terrifying. It had bug eyes, and you know, hair just kind of, you know, going all different ways, sticking up, and you know, feathers sticking out of its head, and you know, it had a mask, of course, on. It was very frightening. And this Kachina had a butcher knife about a foot long, you know, and he walked right by me, and I kind of backed up because, you know, I didn't know what was going to come of this, you know. I mean, these Kachinas, these giant Kachinas that the Hopi talk about, you know, they talk about these legends of giants coming in, and sometimes if the kids are misbehaving or, you know, not being not acting like good Hopi children, these giants will abduct them and, you know, cannibalize them. So there's a way to keep the Hopi kids in line, I guess. You don't want to be abducted by these giant creatures. But, you know, the Hopi have these legends of giants, and also, you know, these ant people, the Anunnaki, Anusinom, which literally means ant people. So you know, this is the way they educate the children, I guess, and keep them on the straight and narrow.
There are many other Native American tribes that have similar stories embedded in their lore about giants and about how the giants were very real, and at one time the people in the various regions were in great fear of the giants. So it's interesting that this also should come up in the Hopi lore. In the time we have left in the first hour, Gary, another thing that's of interest is, again, the correspondences we referred to earlier. Some of the symbolism seems to be related to symbolism found elsewhere around the world, such as the Sanskrit Om symbol, the swastika, mm-hmm, the Maltese cross. You know, you can take it, you know, bits and pieces, and you can finish up on this thought in the next hour. But can you talk a bit about some of these common symbols that seem to be showing up in the Hopi culture?
Sure. Yeah. For instance, the swastika is not not a symbol of, merely of the Third Reich that we think of, but it's an ancient Native American symbol that's used. The Navajo have the same symbol of the swastika. And the swastika is symbolic of basically the four directions. And the Hopi in their migrations after they came up out of the earth from the third world to the fourth, they had to go on these migrations to the four different directions. And the swastika is the way they symbolize these four directions that they migrated to. And even today they have the symbol on the dance rattles that you see in the Kachina dances. They have this symbol, the swastika symbol, on these dance rattles that they use. But, you know, there is a lot of carryover between the old world and the new. We can talk about this maybe in the next hour, about Kincaid's cave and the artifacts that they supposedly found in the Grand Canyon, different Egyptian and Near Eastern artifacts that they found. But, you know, there is a lot of symbolism between the two cultures, the Native American culture and the Near East, for instance, you know, that are the same. And, you know, we can talk about this a little more as we go along.
One of the things that, you know, while we still have time in the first hour, the origin of the Hopi Snake Clan, there seems to be a correlation or a connection to the Indus Valley civilizations and the stories of the Nagas, the serpent worship that came from the subcontinent. Do you want to talk about that?
Sure, yeah. The Nagas, as you say, came from the Indus River Valley in India, but they were a global civilization, and they sailed basically all over the world. And they sailed from India to the east into the Pacific. And I think that's probably where the Hopi came into contact with them, because, as I said before, the Hopi were in the Pacific region. And my books, you know, detail some evidence that, you know, it is not just the myths, but, you know, I have some genetic evidence that points to the fact that the Hopi actually were in Polynesia and these places, and then they came eastward. They sailed eastward across the Pacific to the North American continent. But I think, you know, the Hopi probably were in contact with the Nagas in the Western Pacific region and in the Southern Pacific area. And they took their knowledge of the snake people into North America. And in fact, my book, I'm working on a book now called The Journey of the Serpent People. And this will talk about the way the Hopi migrated from this area. And there is a particular legend that talks about a young boy named Teo, which literally means boy in Hopi, and he visited the island of the Serpent People. He went down the Colorado River. You know, they were already established in Arizona, northern Arizona, and he was wondering where this river was flowing, the Colorado River, which flows south into the Baja region of California. And he went down this river in a sealed log, okay, and he sailed out into the Pacific Ocean, and he went to this island of the Serpent People. He was assisted by a figure named Spider Grandmother, which plays a large part in Hopi lore as well. But he went to this island of the Snake People, and he watched, you know, these people turn into snakes. He went down into their snake kiva, he called it, and these people, you know, actually turned into serpents and began to do ceremonies. The serpent people taught this young boy Teo how to do the snake dance. Okay, and so, you know, he learned how to do this ceremony, and he took it back to Arizona with him. He also took a snake bride with him, took her to Arizona, and, you know, he began doing the snake dance, and the snake dance is still performed every other year in August on the Hopi Mesas, it's a way to, again, bring rain to this very arid place. Snakes are known all over the world for symbolizing water and fertility. So, you know, he started doing these snake dances to help the rainfall come. So, you know, he got this information from somewhere in the Pacific, this snake island somewhere in the Pacific. It was an island, the island of the Nagas, you know, that he came across. So this is the link that the Hopi still celebrate between, you know, these Naga people, these serpent people, and you know, what they do today on the Hopi Mesas.
Fascinating story. Well, we've reached the end of the first hour. My very special guest is Gary David, the OrionZone.com. And he's written a book called The Orion Zone, and definitely would want to hear more about the serpent people. Please go to our website and sign up and become a member, and we will see you at the top of the next hour.